Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
We don't expect a whole lot of change this time of year as we get the harvest underway and moving along quickly in the south.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey looking at wheat.
38% good to excellent. No change from last week. 29% very poor to poor. Slight improvement from last week's 31%. But it doesn't help when your number one production state, Kansas, is also the number one state for very poor to poor ratings. Current number, 54%, even though that does represent a slight improvement over recent weeks, it still is reflective of the trouble that is facing winter wheat producers to try to get this crop in the bin this year. And it also does not help that some of that drought has spread to the Northwest, where we have Oregon, 40% of the winter wheat currently rated very poor to poor.
This is Agriculture Today.
As someone who came in as a legislator, I definitely thought, let me go this way or that way. And I was going for the things that were definitely within my comfort zone.
And now she's a member of the House Ag Committee. Freshman congressman from the 30th District of Texas, Jasmine Crockett.
I can honestly say that I am not a green thumb girl at all, so definitely did not think that ag was the place that I would land, but I feel so honored and blessed to serve on the ag committee.
Normally, we might think a farmer would be good to have, but sometimes it's good to have someone who doesn't know.
That is a positive thing. Yeah, I've done more learning on this committee than I've done on my other committee, for sure.
She says since she doesn't know production ag, there's no preconceived notions. Now, she does know inner cities. She serves Dallas, and a community in the southern portion of her district is Bonton.
So most people don't understand that a lot of the struggles in rural America mirror inner city, lower socioeconomic issues. And so you talk about Bonton, and it just lights me up because Bonton Farms is really this amazing kind of bright spot in my district, right? But the conception for it was the fact that in my district, which is inner city, we experience food deserts. And we know that if there's a food desert, that also affects whether or not you've got positive or negative health outcomes. Because our food is our medicine, right? And so it affects whether or not, say, your obesity levels. It affects, and honestly, we know how many illnesses come along with obesity. And so we know that you have a higher likelihood to end up in the hospital. So it's bigger than just the fact that, hey, I've got to eat, you know, Fritos instead of necessarily having an apple. We're talking about your life expectancy. We're talking about my kiddos and the lack of the development, the full development of their minds. We know that food is so much more crucial to those itty bitty minds to make sure that they are learning and maximizing their learning opportunities. And so it's a big issue in rural America as well as urban America. And when we look at it, it comes down to profits, right? And I'm not against anybody making money. I mean, I'm not against that. We live in a capitalist society for sure. But I can't force a grocer to come in when they say, hey, looking at these numbers, we just can't make the profits. We will go under. But there should be other options. And so, you know, we're hoping that we can get legislation passed that would allow for co-ops to be able to invest in themselves and say, you know what, we don't have the money ourselves, but if we can go and get this loan, then maybe we can fill in the gaps and help out in some of these food deserts and better the health outcomes for our communities. That way, we're not relying upon, say, this for-profit organization to come in, this for-profit organization that has never wanted to come in, right? Because if they did, they would have been there. It's crucial. And we know that when you're looking at a food desert, you're also dealing with the health deserts as well as the educational deserts. Like, people end up leaving because they just don't have access to the basics that they need.
Texas Representative Jasmine Crockett. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's a big change from home. The two-room schoolhouse that I did grade school in on the ranch, one of the rooms was about as big as this office. And there were four grades in it at one point in time.
Zach Ducheneau is from South Dakota, serves as administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency.
I had the good fortune later in life to have a professional career in farm advocacy and in the nonprofit sector. So I had worked at the Intertribal Ag Council for full-time for 11 years when I got this opportunity. So I'd been used to being on the road, a lot of hotels, a lot of time in the city. So I'd kind of had some adjustment period prior to this. So it wasn't such a huge culture shock. And I've told people all across the country I'd live anywhere on the planet to be able to do this job.
And with his office in Washington, D.C., it's like running a major corporation.
It's a big entity. There are 2,100 plus county offices around the country, 51 state offices, and we've got about 10,000 employees out there. We deliver several dozen programs to over 3 million producers and also have about a $30 billion direct and guaranteed loan portfolio. So it's a really big and meaningful part of the rural ag economy.
And one of the hallmarks of the FSA is CRP, Conservation Reserve Program.
It's one of the largest voluntary conservation programs in the world. And in the 2018 Farm Bill, we were given what we took as a target of 27 million acres to enroll. Right now, we're around 24 million with the 1 million acres that we've enrolled this year that we've accepted offers on. And a record interest in our grassland CRP program again, as well as some really pivotal, game-changing CREP agreements, Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. So there's two sign-up periods for our CRP program. The general sign-up, which wrapped up April 27th, I believe maybe April 7th, but earlier in the spring, and then grassland CRP has a sign-up that closed the end of May. In addition to those two sign-up periods, there are continuous opportunities to enroll in this conservation program, and that's our continuous CRP, which includes the Clear 30 initiative for water and water quality enhancement, the Safe Acres program, which is about wildlife habitat in the states, and then the CREP agreements that we have all across the country. A couple of examples of those I think are really helpful, Tony, to help people understand the breadth of opportunity. We were just over in Colorado for the signing of the Republican River CREP agreement. And in that agreement, we're helping producers enroll in this conservation program as a means to transition away from irrigated practices that they were going to be forced out of anyway because of water compact issues. So it helps them make that transition on their terms, realize a rental income, get some incentive payments to help establish a vegetative stand, and transition into the next iteration of agriculture on their operation. Another example I like to highlight is the work that we're doing in Indian Country. We just signed our first CRP contract under the CREP agreement with the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. And that opportunity has the potential to bring 1 million acres of grassland into the Conservation Reserve Program in one of those communities that had really, frankly, been marginalized in the past in the USDA's approach to serving producers.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The ad hoc disasters that we've had have been extremely beneficial.
So Barry Evans is a diversified producer from Swisher County, Texas, talking about the ad hoc or emergency relief programs for farmers.
And one thing that the ad hoc disasters show is that the Farm Bill funding is inadequate, and we've had to come in with ad hocs to supplement it. And it just exemplifies how inadequate the prices are in the Farm Bill. So if we can take some of that money that we've been spending on ad hoc disasters and get it in the Farm Bill, maybe to help improve crop insurance, help improve our safety net, I think it'd be good for the government, because we wouldn't have these ad hoc spending that just comes out of wherever. You know, it could be planned and budgeted, and we would know. And then from the farmer's perspective, we we don't have to count on an ad hoc, because you can't count on it. We would have something we could count on every year, and we could really, really help our planning and just create a lot of stability for our agriculture.
What about the idea of moving ad hoc investments into the farm bill? Evan says,
I think if we could get away from the ad hoc and get that disaster money in the farm bill, it, like I say, it would create stability. It'd make the lenders, just feel so much more secure about where the borrowers are. I think your point about the rural communities would be good. You just can be able to plan and have some more sure feeling about where we are instead of just counting on this ad hoc from year to year.
He's represented by Jody Arrington from the 19th Congressional District of Texas, the chairman of the House Budget Committee.
I talk regularly with Chairman Thompson, and in fact, I did a Zoom call with producers back in West Texas, and he was our special guest and gave everybody an update. He was when he got the gavel, a farm bill process takes a lot of time, and usually it's 2 years of lots of meetings with lots of groups throughout the country. By the time he got the gavel, we were about halfway there, but we were way behind. He has more than made up in terms of engaging the stakeholders. I think he knows exactly what has to be done to make it work for our producers and for rural communities. And I think the debt ceiling deal that included some reform to SNAP with respect to work requirements should take a little pressure off of that process of negotiating with Democrats, between Republicans and Democrats, and between the House and the Senate. Because every year the big rub is reforms to the food stamp program versus the resources needed to make the farm programs a meaningful and responsible safety net. And I think we've made that negotiation. We've dialed it down a lot by dealing with some of the SNAP stuff ahead of time.
He also talks about fighting the fight.
Free and fair trade, along with a good farm bill, along with reasonable regulations, thank God the courts overturned Wars of the U.S., is the recipe for prosperity in rural America. So I look forward to talking about the trade opportunities and making USMCA work. A lot to talk about there.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The Prime Act is a bill. Thomas Massey is the primary sponsor of that. I'm a co-sponsor. And essentially what it does is it rewrites the statutes and gets rid of a lot of the regulations that the federal government started imposing in the 1960s that make it extremely difficult, especially for a state like Wyoming, where we don't have big packers or big packing plants, for us to be able to adequately process the meat and on behalf of our farmers and ranchers, local communities, restaurants, and everything else.
Harriet Hageman is a representative from Wyoming, a member of the Judicial Committee.
The way the situation is right now is that unless the facility is USDA inspected, if it is state inspected, it has to meet the exact same extremely stringent requirements that a federal facility has to meet, but we can only sell intrastate. So it makes absolutely no sense. We have really put up barriers to our ability for our local producers to reach out to restaurants, for example, and provide their local beef for that, or for our ranchers to custom feed and custom butcher for people. The laws make no sense. They're very draconian, and we're trying to fix that. We had four incredible witnesses. I would encourage people to go and watch the committee hearing today. It lasted just a couple of hours. I realize that's a lot of time, but I think that we presented some extremely important information for our cattle and hog and chicken producers. And we also started addressing the fact very openly about the fact that we have a monopolistic situation with the four big packers in this country, and that needs to change. We've got a situation with agency capture where those four packers basically control the USDA and the FDA when it comes to things associated with our meat production And we need to change that. They're the ones that are raking in massive amounts of cash. They're trying to vertically integrate the cattle industry. They've largely done that with pigs and chickens, but they're also trying to vertically integrate our cattle industry, and I think it would be really devastating. We need to move away from the monopolistic model, and we need to expand our availability for packing, for butchering, and have more custom-type operations.
Another member of the Judicial Committee is Tom Tiffany from Wisconsin.
Primarily deals with both beef and pork. We've seen this consolidation of the meat packing industry. It's been a problem for a long time, but it continues to this day. And Representative Massey out of Kentucky has a proposal that would encourage small meat processors to go into business. And what I think follows from that is you're going to see some farmers that are ranchers that are willing to get into the business that may not grow as many cattle. Because when you have just the big operations, the big meat packers, they want those semi-loads coming in. And if you have smaller meat processors, they'll take those 2, 3, 4 cattle and process them. And, you know, we're really fortunate in Wisconsin because we have hundreds of these small meat processors, unlike many other states. And you just think about COVID, when some states, they were having to slaughter cattle because they couldn't, the major meat packers in a few instances were closed down. We didn't have that problem. In fact, they were coming to Wisconsin, some farmers, and saying, can you take my animals? So we're fortunate in that way, and I think we should facilitate that because it helps both, it helps a small processor stay in business, it helps small farmers, but it's also good for the consumer because you've got more choices then.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Like any insurance product, there are a lot of choices.
Kansas State Ag Policy Specialist Jenny Ift on the annual forage insurance program.
First of all, just to back up a little bit, you know, it covers a crop that's used for forage or to feed livestock. So as long as it's annually grown, it could be grazed, it could be hayed, it could be for silage, green chop, any of those type of uses. Again, it's insuring against lower precipitation than normal. So there can be other causes of low yield. It's not going to cover all of them. It's going to cover low precipitation, which we had an awful lot of recently in this state and several states throughout the West. So annual forage is going to cover the risk of lower precipitation than normal, but it's not for a particular field or farm or ranch. It's lower precipitation in a grid, and that's about 14 by 16 miles. So it's going to be smaller than a county, and it's going to be bigger than a lot of farms.
She also talks about the options available in the program.
There's several. So one is a coverage level, and this is a standard choice with nearly any crop or forage insurance product. For annual forage, it goes from 70 to 90% in 5% increments. So a higher coverage level, you're more likely to get a payout, and your payout's going to be a higher value. So it's pretty simple when you think of it. 90% is, think of 90% of normal precipitation. So if precipitation is lower than 90%, you get a payout. If you pick the 70%, your precipitation has to drop below 70% of the historic average to get a payout.
Says for the most part, producers should be able to find a combination that fits their operation.
And so, you know, if you think about, you know, different types of crops, you go for grazing or haying, they can have a wide range of values, a wide range of costs, and a wide range of production. So instead of having particular types of crops that you can select, what you have instead is this thing called a productivity factor. And that's going to scale up or down the value of your crop or your insurance guarantee from 60% of the county average to 150% of the county average. So if you're growing a higher value crop, you could choose to have a higher productivity factor. If you're growing a lower value crop, you could choose to have a lower productivity factor. Some producers may also choose to have that lower productivity factor just to manage the cost of the insurance.
And then there are the growing seasons.
So the growing season is going to correspond to when your crop is grown. So usually there will be early and late planting. So it's like other crop policies where you have an early and late planting date. So that's going to be a month or month and a half before the growing season begins. And then what you're doing is you're insuring against lower than normal rainfall during that growing season. The growing season is a 7-month period. and the producer has to pick. And within that, there's intervals, two-month intervals. So it's 7 months, but the intervals are 2 months. So usually you're going to have two or three intervals within that seven-month period. If a producer has never done this, it's a little bit more complicated. There's some more learning here. But what's really important is that you get to pick, to some degree, what are the most important periods within the growing season that you're insuring for. So first of all, there's weights for each interval. So typically, you can max out at 40%. There are a couple of growing seasons where you can have 50% intervals now. But that 40%, so you could do one at 40% max, the next one at 40%, 20%. So there's different weights you can give. You know, a producer can go back and look at their yield history, or, you know, if they have some idea of what forage yields are, they can select those weights there. But, you know, it is something that can be personalized to a particular producer situation.
Deadline to sign up, July 15th. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The House Agriculture Committee was my number one selection for committee assignment when I came in as a freshman, in part because I knew it was a farm bill year, so that was where the action was going to be.
She's a new member to Congress and a new member on the House Ag Committee from Illinois, Nikki Budzinski.
But also I'd say it's a great committee for so many wonderful deliverables for Central and Southern Illinois, which is the part of the state that I represent in the 13th District. And so really excited to be a part of this committee. And I would say too, Tony, it's a bipartisan committee. It's still, as you know, one of the few places in Washington where we can work together across the party aisle to get things done. I've tried to do that in this first 7 months in office, introduce some legislation that supports our family farmers, put on a bipartisan basis.
She also talks about the importance of hearing from stakeholders or farmers and ranchers.
One of the things I thought was really important when I first took office was to actually set up an agricultural advisory council in the district so that I could hear directly from all of the different stakeholders within Central and Southern Illinois that the House Agriculture Committee is going to touch on. And so obviously the Illinois Farm Bureau has one of those seats at the table, but I'm also really excited that we have a lot of our great universities. You know, the University of Illinois, our College of ACES program is a world-class agriculture program that I'm really proud to get the chance to represent. But we launched our first council meeting actually at Lincoln Land Community College. We've got great community colleges in Central and Southern Illinois that are leading the way in agricultural research and innovation. Precision agriculture, Parkland Community College was the first community college in the country to have a certified program in precision ag. So getting to advocate for those types of issues and to hear directly from my agricultural advisory council on the issues that they care the most about, knowing that I'm a freshman going into a farm bill year, that there's a lot to learn, but there are so many opportunities for us in Central and Southern Illinois in this committee. That's why I'm so excited to serve on it.
And on the topic of rural health care?
I think in rural communities like those that I come from, those that I represent, we have unique challenges when it comes to health care and access to health care. Our rural hospitals are facing the pinch financially for a lot of different reasons, but one of them in particular is our workforce shortages. We have a real challenge attracting specialty care. You know, I talk very openly about the fact that I do believe we have a mental health crisis in this country that has left no community untouched. That's young, old. I hear about that actually from our Agricultural Advisory Council. Family farmers. Farmers are facing mental health challenges as we have a pretty volatile market right now and what that means. And so how are we making sure that people in these communities get the health care access that they need to the specialists? And so one of the things, again, a bipartisan piece of legislation I've introduced is the Rural Health Corps Act, which would basically say to healthcare professionals that come to our community, stay in our community for 5 years, we're going to help relieve some of your student debt. And I think that's just one small way that we can help to incentivize people to stay in our wonderful communities that we have, continue to practice, and as an end result, help my constituents get the access to the specialty healthcare that we need. I think it's incredibly, incredibly important. And something I would mention, too, you know, I know we're going to talk a lot about the House Ag Committee, but my second committee is the House Veterans Affairs Committee, which is so important. I serve on the Health Subcommittee. Using that platform of that subcommittee, I'm really trying to lean in on health care and specifically rural health care for our veterans as well. So lots to do in this space, and I'm hoping our legislative initiative will come to fruition and we'll be able to provide some relief to some of these communities.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
In July, we're going to be welcoming our first shipment of U.S. cherries into India, and we hope to be building on that success in the future.
Sochil Torres-Small is USDA's Undersecretary for Rural Development.
While I was there, I had the chance to experience a Taste of America event, which we held, which is a marketing event. And during that time where American food products were featured in Indian cuisine, I had two importers actually just come up to me and say, hey, we're interested in more wholesale almonds if you know of where we can get them. So it was exciting to be part of those conversations and expanding those markets. Agricultural exports in FY21 were valued at $177 billion. And then in FY22, $196 billion. That's two record-setting years for agricultural exports. So it shows that this type of engagement is crucial, both in terms of international relations, but also for farmers back home.